This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On Monday, Sung-Hui Cho, an English major at Virginia Tech, killed 32 fellow students and professors, injured many more, and then killed himself. As the community and the nation deal with the shock, the questions being asked include why this happened and whether it might have been prevented. Yesterday on this program, one of Cho's professors told us that she and other teachers became so worried that they reported their concerns to the authorities. And today, university police said they'd taken Cho to a mental health facility after two female students complained about harassment and after his parents called, worried that he might commit suicide. While there's a great deal about Cho's mental health we have no way to know, his case raises questions about mental illness and the law. If there's no criminal act, can someone be forced into treatment? Should they? Is there any reliable way to predict who might turn violent and who's harmless? Later in the program, NPR political editor Ken Rudin joins us for our regular visit with the political junkie. This week, the prospects for new gun control legislation in Congress. The president meets with top Democrats on Iraq war funding and three governor's races coming up later this year. If you have questions for the political junkie, you can send them to us by email now. The email address is talk@npr.org. But first, predicting violent behavior. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And you can also comment on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. We begin here in Studio 3A with health policy correspondent Joanne Silberner. Always good to have you on the program.
Good to be here, Neil.
And Joanne, every time there's one of these incidents, it seems that questions arise about mental health. And could this have been prevented? Could it have been detected ahead of time?
It's enormously difficult. You know, if you look at just compare this case to the Columbine case, you know, completely different details. There are so, you know, there's so many people with mental illness who don't do this. When you have the extremely rare case where someone does and you try to look for patterns, you don't have enough to compare it to.
And that thereby lies the problem. Is there just not enough data to say, well, thereby we can predict?
In a strict way, yeah. I mean, you know, you can be suspicious. Certainly his classmates, you know, what's coming out today, what's new today is that his classmates were quite suspicious. His teachers were suspicious. He had been in a mental health facility. The police had been looking into his activities, but no one had lodged an official complaint. They couldn't go any further.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there other people can be suspicious. Other people can be very shy, and nothing happens along the way. Picking the one out is just almost impossible.
And again, going back to the Columbine case, it turned out that indeed one of the boys was in was being treated.
Right, but as I said, you know, most people being treated, this is not a routine or even occasional event. It's extraordinarily rare.
Well, let's get an expert on the line. Joining us is John Monahan, professor of law and professor of psychology and psychiatric medicine at the University of Virginia Law School. He joins us from the studios at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you very much.
And what can you tell us about, can psychiatrists or doctors predict who might become violent and who might not?
Well, I think it's been known for a very long time that psychologists and psychiatrists are not very good at predicting violence. I think that they're better than chance, just not much better than chance. Fortunately, in recent years, I think the science has improved considerably, and there's now a variety of tools available to help psychiatrists and psychologists make more accurate predictions, tools that are based on research into what the risk factors for violence really are. But still, our crystal balls are very murky, and we have a long way to go to really understand what makes anyone act violently, let alone act violently on such a horrific scale.
Yeah, and presumably those tools involve somebody coming in to take the kinds of tests that you'd be looking for.
Absolutely.
And there's no way, as far as I understand, there's no way if somebody's over the age of 18 or 21, to depending on various state laws and that sort of thing, to force them into treatment.
You can't force them into treatment unless they qualify for hospitalization, which in every state requires two things, that the first person be seriously mentally ill and that the person be predicted to be dangerous to self or others.
Mm-hmm.
In recent years, a number of states have passed new laws creating what's called outpatient commitment, requiring some people to get mental health treatment in the community or be put in a hospital. I think these laws are very controversial. Civil libertarians see them as a big brother intrusion by the government on people's freedom to make their own decisions. Others, particularly the family members of people with mental illness, argue that some people who are mentally ill don't realize that they're ill, and so they won't accept treatment voluntarily. Or if they do, they go off their medication as soon as they start to feel better. Mm-hmm. And they argue that these people should be required by law to accept treatment or else they won't get any.
And I think there's another issue here, and that is treatment available? It's very uneven across the country where you can get either inpatient or outpatient treatment.
Dr. Monahan?
Yes.
Yeah, is that right?
I think that the availability of treatment is a key issue. Simply a judge ordering someone by signing a piece of paper to get into treatment is not going to do it. You have to provide good quality treatment that will get people returning to it and will get them improving in their psychological state.
Yeah, there was that case of Andrew Goldstein up in New York. He had a 3,100-page history before he pushed a young woman in front of a subway train. He was on the waiting list for treatment at the time he pushed her in front of the train. He actually wanted treatment. It was recognized that he needed treatment, but he was on a waiting list, mm-hmm. and he just couldn't wait.
John Monahan, without obviously going into the details of the Cho case, which we don't know, are there characteristics or trait behavior patterns that such people who do become horrifically violent, that they have in common?
Well, I don't know about horrifically violent, but in terms of people traits or risk factors for violence, a recent large-scale study that my colleagues and I did for the MacArthur Foundation, we found that there were many different patterns of risk factors. For example, factors what the person is, like gender. Men are more likely to be violent than women. Young people more likely to be violent than older people. People who have difficulty controlling their anger, that's a key risk factor. Mm-hmm. Things like, there's no question that mental disorder, in general, people with serious mental illness are somewhat more likely to be violent than people without any mental illness. I think it's disingenuous and counterproductive to deny that. That being said, the great majority of people with mental illness are never violent to anyone and certainly never commit anything like murder, much less mass murder. They are often very vulnerable people who are much more likely to be the victims of violence than the perpetrators. And when they are violent, they tend to be violent toward family members, not toward strangers.
We're talking with John Monahan, professor of law and professor of psychology and psychiatric medicine at the University of Virginia Law School. Also with us, NPR's health policy correspondent, Joanne Silberner. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's see if we can start with Blake. And Blake is calling us from Berlin, Maryland.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I personally have manic depression, and I'm a writer. And I write some pretty disturbed things, because I have some pretty disturbed thoughts. But I'm on medication, I'm getting help, I'm in therapy. You know, I'm not a danger to others. And I'm just worried about this case stigmatizing people like myself.
John Monahan, clearly he falls into that vast majority of people who are not a threat to himself or to others. And stigmatization is it's bad enough already to the stigma of mental health problems already exists.
It is indeed bad enough already, and some studies have shown that the key factor contributing toward the stigma against people with mental illness is the perceived relationship between mental illness and violence. So I think that the ready availability of services for people with mental illness, like manic depression, I think is one key issue that can come from the research in this area.
Mm-hmm. Joanne?
You know, in terms of writing, when you look at it, I mean, look at Shakespeare, look at Hamlet. You know, he's got some very violent concepts in there. You know, an uncle killing the father. You could look at that and say, well, this is a very disturbed mind. And then you take a look back and say, well, wait, that was Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. And just looking back, Kurt Vonnegut struggled with depression, and so did William Styron, famously. So, Blake, I think you're in pretty good company.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much for the phone call. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And why don't we try, this is Eric. Eric's calling us from Cincinnati.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
kind of an interesting perspective I think I have, because I'm both very involved in target shooting, and I've enjoyed that for a number of years. But I've also struggled with depression for many years, probably since childhood. And I have to say that in terms of the treatment that I got for depression, it was often really sorely lacking. And had I been screened and treated better, probably I wouldn't have to be dealing with it, you know, at the age where I am right now, which is in my 40s. The other thing is your caller, or rather one of your guests said, simply, you know, because you have a quote-unquote mental illness doesn't mean you're going to take it out on other people. But I just feel like the system failed me. In high school, they said I had an emotional disability, and absolutely nothing was done. Nothing whatsoever. And, you know, I wish that in addition to better screening for everybody, there was a lot more support for people. And as far as the gun culture is concerned, millions and millions of people own guns in this country. They go to sleep. They don't commit crimes with them. They're in their houses. They sure are deadly. There's no question about it. But it's wrong to stigmatize the entire gun carrying or gun shooting public. Many, many fine individuals are target shooters, and it helped me to build up my self-esteem.
Okay, I guess that's all Eric has to say. But Joanne Tilburner, as he talks about the point of, you know, clearly, we're getting back to Dr. Monahan's point. You know, yes, a higher percentage of people with mental illness are likely to be involved in violence, yet it's still a very, very, very small percentage.
Right, and stigma has been, I followed the stigma story over time, and just my empirical judgment, it looks like it's lessening a little bit as people come out and talk about their mental illnesses, but it's still there. There's still a lack of understanding. I think this lack of availability of services is a form of stigma. It's people saying through their taxes and through their government, no, we don't want to support this, we don't want to pay for this, when it's an illness just like anything else.
John Monahan, we just have a few seconds before the break, but then again, you turn around to the parents of some of these their children were killed and say, you know, well, we couldn't do anything.
Yes, it's very hardened, and it's not surprising that they're not going to take comfort in the finding that violence like this is extremely rare. For them, it's all that matters. And I think that it's quite right that if better services were available, much of these problems would not occur.
We're talking about whether violent behavior, such as we saw at Virginia Tech earlier this week, is preventable. After the break, a forensic psychiatrist joins us, and we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255. You can also send in your questions by email, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As we learn more about the shooter in the Virginia Tech incident and about the signs of trouble, many wonder if this tragedy could have been prevented, though we'll never know for sure what set off Monday's rampage. Today our focus is on the prediction of violent behavior. Our guests are Joanne Tilburner, NPR health policy correspondent, and John Monahan, professor of law and professor of psychology and psychiatric medicine at the University of Virginia Law School. In a few minutes, we'll also get more information on this intersection of mental health and the law from a forensic psychiatrist. Of course, we want to hear from you as well. Is there any reliable way to predict who might turn violent and who's harmless? If there's no criminal act, can someone be forced into treatment? Should they? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say at our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And here's an email following up on what we were just talking about at the end of the last break. Kelly in Denver, Colorado, I'm not sure the issue was only that of prediction. One of Cho's teachers clearly was worried enough to try to contact authorities, but they could do nothing because they couldn't act unless there was an actual threat. His roommates noticed that he was dissembling. That itself is not a crime. There don't seem to be any laws or valid reasons to hold somebody for treatment unless an attack is stated as imminent. Risk factors cannot be consistently dealt with within the current system. John Monahan, is that right?
I think it is right. Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, if there is a direct threat, you can take action. But absent that, laws in most states would severely restrict what can be done. Even if someone were thinking about committing suicide, of every 1,000 people who think of committing suicide, only one of those 1,000 people actually goes on to commit suicide. So the rights of the other 999 have to be considered.
And if parents are concerned, as they were in this case, of course, their son was over the age of 21, is there anything they can do?
I think given laws in most states, there really is not much parents can do for adult children. As I mentioned, some states are considering changing their laws to allow for mandatory outpatient treatment. But again, absent some kind of serious mental illness and some indication that someone's likely to be violent, there's not that much that can often be done.
Mm-hmm. Let's go talk with Nancy. Nancy calling us from Grand Rapids in Michigan.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
As I'm listening to this, I'm thinking about violence, including murder and suicide, are also consequences of excessive use of alcohol and other drugs, as well as mental illness. And it is possible that there's no law to prevent it for schools, and especially universities, it would be fairly easy for schools to require screening for anxiety, depression, misuse of alcohol, and I don't know about other drugs because mm-hmm. of their illegality. But they could require that as one of the admission standards, and require that the person who shows positive on any of those submit him or herself for treatment as a condition of being admitted to the university. And schools could do that, too. High schools.
Well, just about everybody goes to high school. Only about half of high school graduates go on to college. But, Joanne, is that something that's within the boundaries of the law?
Boy, I would defer that question to Dr. Monahan. I'm just thinking on the social aspect, though, whether universities would be willing to do that.
Well, I don't know whether they'd be willing, but we know that 6% of the kids who enter college each year are already addicted to alcohol or other drugs. And many, I don't know the percentage, have depression and anxiety.
John Monahan?
Well, there's no question the listener is correct that alcohol and substance abuse are much more closely related to violence than is mental illness. In fact, in our study for the MacArthur Foundation, people with mental illness who were not abusing alcohol or other drugs were no more violent than their non-mentally ill neighbors. But when you combine mental illness with substance abuse, that's when the risk of violence increases substantially.
Nancy, interesting thought. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
To talk more about what drives violent behavior, joining us now is Dr. Howard Zonana. He's director of forensic psychiatry at Yale Medical School, and he joins us from Yale Studios in Connecticut. Nice to have you on the program today.
Good afternoon.
And are there characteristics or traits or behavior patterns that, again, we can't know what was in Mr. Cho's mind, but that such people have in common?
Well, I don't think there is any specific characteristics, and one of the problems, of course, is, as you're last caller mentioned, if you try to screen, you will get an enormous number of positive responses of people who are both anxious and depressed. There have been a lot of surveys done in colleges that show that somewhere between 20 and 65% of students at colleges have suicidal ideation at some point or other. Interestingly, though, the suicide rate of people in college is about half that of the general population in terms of matched age controls. And I think what schools try to do is develop university health programs that try to make that readily accessible, and that's because schools have recognized that this is a significant issue for college students.
And when you say ideation, is that just simply thinking about suicide at some point?
Yes, thinking about it. I mean, one can do all sorts of studies on whether one just thinks about it, whether one makes some plans, whether one takes some action toward it. That during adolescence is a time of great psychological turmoil, and it's not surprising to see those kinds of numbers. Mm-hmm. Most people, don't go on and commit suicide.
Again, we heard about Mr. Cho, that he was a loner and angry. Again, that seems to be a common description. Is that a pattern?
Well, again, there are people like that, and one of the questions, of course, is, he sounds somewhat different than just a depression. That degree of isolation and that degree of bizarre writing in a certain way that go together make you wonder whether he had a more significant mental disorder where his reality testing was compromise, whether he was delusional, whether he was hearing voices, all sorts of other things get raised when you see the pattern and look at what happened. Obviously, in retrospect, it's easier than beforehand.
Again, these incidents are rare. Nevertheless, there's been sadly too many of them. And as you look back at the individuals who committed these kinds of crimes, similarities in terms of education, upbringing, socioeconomic background, ethnicity?
I don't think you'll find any specific pattern in either in terms of mental illness. All we can say is, I mean, we see the people who are mentally ill, and they are usually people that have major mental disorders that are usually of psychotic proportion, at least in the people I've seen involved in school shootings and things like that, mm-hmm. where there doesn't seem to be a very rational motive.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Gail, and Gail's with us from Columbus, Ohio.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
I'm calling. I've served as the dean of students at a large university at the graduate school level for many years and have dealt with a lot of students with issues, including students we thought might be a danger to themselves or others. And the thing that's different than talking about, I think, than talking about putting people in for treatment voluntarily in society at large versus the university is there's a whole separate set of rules that exist. I mean, the universities have a responsibility towards their entire student body, and most that I've dealt with are have a code of conduct that, I'm sorry, I'm at an airport, a code of conduct that governs student behavior. And as a result, they have many tools that they can use to help students and protect the student body at large. For example, the university where I've been, we actually have a process if someone comes into us and we think that they may be a harm to themselves or others, can require that they get a mental health evaluation by the university, or they'll outsource it. There are behavior contracts that you can require that students engage in order, and especially if other students feel threatened, as was the case here. So universities have a different relationship, I think, with students than, you know, someone just does in general. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the issues is that legal departments at university are loath to step in issues of mental health. They're worried about liability and ADA issues, rightly so. I think the insurers that we've dealt with have always said to us, if you have to err on the side of violating what's called FERPA, the student, that protects student privacy, you should, if you're really worried about the person, you should always err on the side of protecting the student. In other words, universities don't get sued for being overprotective of students. They get, you know, sued when something unfortunate happens.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, somebody in your situation, this must have been terrible to see what this happened, that this happened at a big public university like Virginia Tech. This must seem very close to home to you.
Yes, and in fact, I have been at a university where there actually was a similar but much an event at a much smaller scale, and it really deeply affects everybody really for years.
I wonder, were you listening earlier when our caller Nancy suggested the idea of screening all students? Was that something that you could foresee?
Actually, not allowed. You're not allowed to ask an application. Have you ever? You know, many years ago when I was applying to college, they did ask that. Have you ever seen anyone, not a health professional? Have you ever been arrested? So those kinds of questions are not allowed. Many of the questions you can ask someone whether there was a gap in their education to try to get at it, but a lot of those questions, are just like they would be in the employment context, are just illegal.
Illegal. And John Monahan, it gets back to that, doesn't it?
Oftentimes it does, but it is the case that universities have a very difficult bind here, that sometimes they have been sued when someone who with a mental illness who they think might be suicidal, when they bar them from the dormitory or they bar them from the college, and then the student later sues them for violating the Americans with Disabilities Act. So I think it's a very fine line here that colleges have to walk, and no one is quite sure what the best approach is, but I am certain that people are thinking about this issue today.
I think, you know, universities just have to keep in mind what's in the best interest of all of their students and that particular student. And it needs, you need a coordinated effort between the counseling department and the administrators in whatever department the student's located. And there needs to be a centralized place for gathering information about the students so that bits and pieces don't get lost, so you're not aware of what a, you know, complete and total picture you have of the problems that a, you know, a student has. Hmm. Everybody might have their own little piece, but unless one person is collecting that information, they might not know how deep the problem is.
Gail, thanks very much. We appreciate the phone call, and sure. I hope you make your flight.
Thank you.
So long. We're talking with NPR's Joanne Silberner. Also with us, John Monahan, professor of law and professor of psychology and psychiatric medicine at the University of Virginia Law School, and Howard Zonana, who's the director of forensic psychiatry division at Yale Medical School. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email we have from Jill in Kalamazoo in Michigan. My 5-year-old son seems to be naturally aggressive. He doesn't watch commercial television, play video games, or see violence anywhere, yet he acts out violently. We've tried to address his temper and high sensitivity with his teachers and pediatrician, and both assure us this is normal. I disagree. To see him hit, kick, yell, and growl over the smallest of issues concerns me. I wonder what I can do to curtail the behavior now. Howard Zonana, is this somebody who should be worried?
Well, these are always ongoing assessments, and as you know, there's a great controversy about both the over- and underdiagnosis of things like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and whether we over-label and then over-medicate, or whether we under-label and don't adequately treat. And these are difficult diagnoses to make. And people feel very strongly about drugs and medication in these kinds of issues. And often it depends on the pervasiveness, how long it lasts, and then whether or not it's worth a trial of medication to see whether or not something more, this is beyond what should be considered normal. But that normal is a range, and that's why you get into this controversy, or why some people feel undertreated and some people feel overtreated.
Let's see if we get one more caller in. This is Karen. Karen with us from Webster, New Hampshire.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling about the mental health system. My son committed suicide when he was 18, and it was over a girl. He had a girlfriend that they broke up, and he wasn't handling it well, and he had never been violent before. He was not violent against her, but he did punch a hole in a wall and you know, kick a door and things like that. He had made a suicide attempt on a Monday. We took him to the emergency room. They sent him home. We watched him like a hawk all week. He didn't eat. He didn't sleep. We took his car keys away from him. And then on the following Friday, he took his father's truck and took off in the middle of the night. So we called the police. And the police recommended we take him back to the emergency room and try to get an involuntary admission. And they wouldn't do it. And 2 days later, he shot himself. And what bothered me more than anything else during this whole ordeal at the emergency room was that I kept asking the mental health practitioner what criteria he was using to determine our son was not a danger to himself or others, because he had just made a previous attempt, you know, four days before. He was not sleeping. He was not eating. He had threatened to go out and buy a gun. And they just kept saying, no, in our opinion, he doesn't pose a danger to himself. And I finally said, you know, he is so unlike himself.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure if he might not kill his girlfriend, too. I said, so if you don't admit him, you know, we don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Karen, first of all, we're very sorry for your loss. Dr. Monahan, can you weigh in on this?
I think oftentimes that family members' views or what family members have experienced is not taken into account in the risk assessment process, as in this tragic case, and I think that it should be.
Karen, I think that's a little comfort at this stage. I'm so sorry for what happened.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. And perhaps tragedy is where we're going to have to end this conversation. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. Dr. Howard Zonana is Director of Forensic Psychiatry Division at Yale Medical School. He joined us from the studios at Yale University. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And Dr. John Monahan, professor of law and professor of psychology and psychiatric medicine at the University of Virginia Law School, joined us from the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Thank you for your time today, sir.
Thank you very much.
And Joanne Silberner, as always, with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much, Joanne.
Thank you.
When we come back from a short break, Ken Rudin stops by for our weekly visit with the Political Junkie. If you have questions about the fight over Iraq funding, upcoming governor's races, or the prospects for gun control legislation in Congress, obviously that discussion renewed after the events in Blacksburg this week, you can give us a call now, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.